A bipartisan group of six senators reached a deal yesterday that would shield Dreamers from deportation and make other changes to immigration laws and border security. But their deal didn't go anywhere. The president took to Twitter to attack Democrats and push for a border wall. We'll break it down with two political perspectives on this edition of Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Joining us to rewind on the top state and national headlines are Rick Essenberg, the president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And Louis Fortas is here. He's editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee and a former member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. Louis, welcome to you.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Rick. Good morning.
Well, let's begin with what everyone is talking about this morning. In a closed-door meeting with a bipartisan group of senators yesterday, President Trump reportedly referred to Haiti, El Salvador, and African nations using very vulgar language. He apparently also said that America should be accepting more people from Norway. And this, of course, has set off a lot of remarks and conversation this morning. The remark was condemned by lawmakers from both parties, including Republican Congresswoman Maya Love of Utah, who is of Haitian descent. So what do we make here? Louis, you first. What's your reaction to all of this?
I mean, tremendous disappointment that that the United States of America has a president who not only feels this way strongly enough that he actually articulates it. It's a disgrace. It's just sad. I mean, this is not the United States that, you know, we all grew up in. This has become a very different situation under Donald Trump. And what it's doing to us overseas and throughout the world is not good. And I'm hoping that, people in other countries understand that this is not how America feels and who America is, but just this one person who, was clever enough to get himself elected, does not represent, a big chunk, the majority of America. And I think if you look at his poll numbers, it shows that today. So anyway, it's sad and disappointing.
Rick, the president tweeted this morning that he used tough language, but denied he said what is being reported. He also tweeted that, quote, he never said anything derogatory about Haitians other than Haiti is obviously a very poor country, poor and troubled country. He said, never said, take them out. What do you make of what's going on?
Well, it would be, I wasn't there. I don't know what he said. I think it would be best if the president not use language like that. It would be best if the president not denigrate other countries, even in semi-private settings. But let me push back gently a little bit, because in Lewis's lifetime, in my lifetime, we had a president named Lyndon Johnson. It was a different world then. The press didn't report on the things that he said, but Lyndon Johnson used quite vulgar and quite frank language very often, and I think that that happens more behind closed doors than we expect. Look, I mean, there are countries in the world that are very, very difficult places. That's one of the reasons that people want to leave them and come to places like the United States of America, and it's tough sometimes for people to make that transition. And so I certainly don't endorse what he is reported to have said, but on the other hand, I don't think I'm going to get the vapors about it either.
Well, Rick, let's put it this, or Louis, go ahead if you want to respond.
Yeah, I do want to respond. I mean, we're not talking about vulgar language. I mean, all the presidents use that. Well, other than perhaps Jimmy Carter and maybe George W. But it's not that. I mean, vulgar language. Richard Nixon was the king of the vulgar language. But and Lyndon Johnson also. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about racist language. I mean, nobody can accuse Lyndon Johnson of having been racist in the sense of...
He is absolutely is accused of using racist language.
Well, I mean, probably by on your side of the aisle, but...
No, by his...
He was the one that... let me finish, Rick. Rick, let me finish, please, and then you can have your chance to talk. I mean, he was... worked in a school with when he was a teacher, which was predominantly Mexican. He was felt very strongly about helping them in every way he possibly could. That was one of the things driving him with a lot of the legislation that was passed in the 60s. And he was the one that bit the bullet and lost the South for the Democrats over the next since he passed the legislation and step out and do the right thing. On civil rights. So, you can say what you want. His actions spoke a lot louder than anything that you might be saying or your friends might.
Let me jump in here for just a moment. And Rick, I'm going to give you the floor here in just a moment, but I want to pose it to you this way, Rick. You know, here is the gang of six senators coming to President Trump's door yesterday with a compromise plan, a bipartisan plan, and the president tells them to keep working, doesn't want to look at that plan, perhaps. What do you want to see him do right now with immigration?
Well, first of all, I'd like us to focus on substance. And, of course, I'm not saying that Lyndon Johnson was racist. He used racist language. He used the N-word. And we have this tendency now to sort of to glom on to what people say in unguarded moments and then conclude that that tells us something profound and permanent about them. And I think oftentimes that dumbs down our public discourse. What we have going on right now, let's get to the substance of the question that you asked, is a possibility to move forward on immigration, something that we haven't been able to do for the longest period of time. And what we have here is quite simple. President Obama engaged in an illegal action. Right? He initially he said, "There's nothing I can do about the Dreamers because I can't pass the law." And then when Congress didn't act, he decided that he had a pen, he had a phone, and he would simply change the law, and he would systematically refuse to enforce it. That was illegal. That was unconstitutional. And the fact that you might like the policy that he adopted doesn't make it any less legal, doesn't make it any less unconstitutional. Now we have an opportunity to fix that. We have an opportunity to do the right thing by a group of people that everybody wants to help out. But at the same time, it's reasonable for the president and the Republicans to say, look, at the same time, we've got to address the problem that led to the situation that caused DACA and DAPA to be implemented in the first place. We've got to get control of our borders. There's no country in the world that does this. And the public has lost confidence in us. They know that we can grant amnesty. They know that we can allow people into the country who are not supposed to be here unlawfully. But the public hasn't seen that we can get control of our borders. And so this is what we've got to do. We've got to cut a deal. And if the deal doesn't happen, if DACA doesn't happen, and if DAPA doesn't happen, if these aren't regularized and made things that are adopted and administered under the rule of law rather than executive fiat, it's going to be on Democrats because there's a deal to be had here.
Lewis, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said he was encouraged with President Trump's apparent openness to protecting Dreamers, but said the devil lies in the details with regard to beefing up security. What would you like to see happen with regard to these immigration negotiations?
First of all, we all saw on tape, or it was recorded, where he had that little dog and pony show where he was going to show that he understands policy and all. And at that meeting, he said that he would sign whatever the Congress would bring to him. Whether I like it or not, I will sign it. I have great respect for all the people in the room here, and whatever you bring to me, I will sign. And so they bring him something. They work it out as a bipartisan compromise, all that good stuff. They bring it to him, and he says no. And if this is how the great negotiator negotiates, I mean, this is amazing. So anyway, what I would like to do is see him sign the bill that was brought to him by a bipartisan group of legislators that has support in both houses, apparently. And this is an issue that is really kind of unfortunate. You have these young people that are no longer that young anymore. They've been, you know, they are Americans. They've lived in America for years and years. There's several thousand of these DACA young people who are school teachers, for example. And these are the people that, you know, you're talking about, you know, he's always talking about wanting the good immigrants or whatever. You can't get much better than this. These are the best. And they've gone to college and they've you know, raised families and they've done all this stuff, and he wants to give it to them. So I think he should just do what he said he was going to do, and that's basically sign the legislation. But I want to go back to Rick's point about this is an illegal action and, you know, the creating DACA. I'm not a great fan of these executive orders. I think that they, both sides and previous administrations did exactly the same thing that as Obama did, is they use these executive orders. For Rick to be, you know, definitively saying this is an illegal action, this is what his will group, which is a very extreme right-wing, legal think tank, I mean, this is their position. And, you know, and I respect, I think it's wrong, and I think it's up to the courts to decide this, but, you know, for it's not declared an illegal action. It's right now the law of the land. And we should be, straightforward about this.
Well, let's pause for a moment. We are in Week in Review. Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Louis Fortas is editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. You can join the roundtable conversation at 800-642-1234. Is President Trump mentally fit and stable genius, as he puts it, or do you doubt his mental capacity? How do you feel about the possibility of Oprah Winfrey running for president in 2020? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Rick, I want to toss it back to you. 200,000 Salvadoran immigrants with temporary protected status, or TPS, will have until September 9th of next year to leave the U.S. or face deportation. This week, El Salvador became the fourth country since the president took office to lose protection under TPS, which provides humanitarian relief for people whose countries are hit with natural disasters and other strife. What do you make of this move?
Well, you know, they have temporary protective status. Temporary protective status is temporary and is supposed to be predicated on the presence or absence of certain extraordinary conditions. When those extraordinary conditions cease to exist, then their protected status is revoked. That is, it is not they're not invited and free to live here for the rest of their lives. It's sort of a temporary refugee status. And it would be an objection to revoking TPS status to say that the conditions that led to that status being granted are still present. I don't know enough about what's happening in El Salvador or Honduras to comment on that. It is not a valid objection to revoking TPS status to say, well, these folks want to stay here, or economic conditions in El Salvador and Honduras are still tough because, poverty or a tough economy are not among the conditions that lead to the conferral of TPS status. And so, I think that the question really turns on whether the conditions that allowed that status to be granted are still present or not. And I'm not going to pretend that I know what's going on in El Salvador and Honduras, because you don't.
Louis, is this week's development another layer on the immigration debate?
I think it's another. First of all, I agree with Rick, and I'm surprised I'm saying this, on the fact that this temporary protective status that they had, this has been going on for a long, long time, And, you know, did the conditions change in these countries? Probably. Some of them were emergency conditions, I think, because of weather situations, hurricanes or something of that sort. But if I recall, the conditions down in these countries are very, very dangerous, and people are coming up here for, safety reasons because they're feeling targeted in these countries. So the thing is, they've been living here for many, many years. They have children who are American citizens who were born here. And so then I think they should be looked at as a case-by-case basis. And if folks have been, abiding by the law and whatever, then I think they should have a right to apply for some kind of status, because these countries are dangerous right now. I mean, real dangerous. There's gangs that just killing people. And you're saying, well, that's their problem. No, it's not their problem. The problem is these were, L.A. gangs, and people were being deported, and they took their gang activities down to El Salvador and places like that, where they had less police control, and these gangs got very strong down there. And that's what, is frightening people, one of the things that's frightening people down there. So so we've been somewhat responsible in a lot of different ways, and historically we've certainly been, somewhat responsible. And so I think you look at this on a case-by-case basis and say, you take somebody who's been living here many years, have their children are American citizens, and just say, okay, temporary status is over, you're all going, being shipped back. I think that's kind of beneath us, and I think we as a country can do a little better than that.
President Trump is expected to undergo his first medical checkup since taking office today, as questions surrounding his mental stability swirl in the wake of a bombshell book, Fire and Fury, about his approach to governance. We're talking about it on this edition of Week in Review. Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And Louis Fortas is editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What about the president's fitness for the job? How do you feel about the possibility of Oprah Winfrey running for president in 2020? Is Governor Walker right or wrong when he says he doesn't need more Madison, that we don't need more Madison in our lives? 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in a moment. People are snapping up Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury, his account of President Trump's first year in the White House. It's selling so fast that bookstores have run out, and his publisher is rushing to deliver more. One of the side notes on this Week in Review, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our guests are Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and Louis Fortas is here, Editor-in-Chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. And you, what political story from the past week do you want to discuss? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So after the release of the book that portrays the president as a leader who doesn't understand the weight of his presidency, President Trump is defending his mental fitness and intelligence. He tweeted Saturday that his two greatest assets have been mental stability and being, really smart. Rick, do you have any concerns about whether the president may be mentally unfit for office, or is that completely ridiculous?
Well, I think the notion that we can diagnose someone's psychiatric condition based upon, their public statements is a quite dangerous one. There's a long history of people attempting to medicalize, political differences going back to, Richard Hofstadter wrote a very, very bad book in the mid-1960s. Trump tweets stupid and silly things. I don't think anybody would, I can't say that nobody would, but I think it's fair to say that hand, I have to admit, and I've not been a particular fan of Donald Trump, there are things about both Trump the person and the forces that propelled Trump to the nomination that do concern me. If you look at the way that Trump has actually governed, what the administration has actually done, he's governed as a, you know, fairly traditional conservative president, sort of putting aside the tweets and all the statements he makes. And I'm not suggesting that you can do that completely, but if you look at the policies that actually have been adopted, they're pretty much what you'd expect from a Republican president. To some extent, the people that propelled Trump to the nomination have been disappointed, I think, in some of the things that the president has done. And so I think that the notion that, you know, that we should be talking about the 25th Amendment or that the president is unstable based upon a book by a guy, this guy Wolf, who has a horrible reputation, and a number of the things that he's reported in the book have been disproven. But I think some of them are probably true in this, but I think that there's probably a fair amount of chaos in the White House. It's not unusual, particularly in the first year of the administration. This one may be worse. But I don't think that the question of the president's mental stability or health is one that is raised at this point.
Lewis, the president has a physical today. How worried are you about President Trump's competence as commander-in-chief?
First of all, since there's no other Republican other than Rick here on the, I'll have to kind of argue from the Republican side here initially. I think a lot of Republicans would be appalled to say Trump represents their positions other than his tweeting or whatever. I mean, most Republicans over the years have been very strong free traders, for example. They were internationalists, and they believe strongly in free trade. And Trump has gone the exact opposite direction. So I think he's been acting like Republicans in the sense of, you know, cutting taxes for the wealthy and things like that. But I think there's a lot of other issues that he certainly deviates from the Republican Party, just to set the record straight. But but back to your question now here. It's really sad when president has to get up there and be saying, you know, I'm real smart. I'm very stable. I'm a very stable genius. It reminds you of Nixon when he was proclaiming, "I'm not a crook. I'm not a crook." So when the president of the United States has to be trying to convince the public that he's either not a crook or that he's not unstable and that he's actually, you know, somewhat smart and all that stuff, there's some problems going on here. But you know, people talk about exercising this 25th Amendment. That's not what's, you know, that's silly talk in the sense that he is capable of doing the job. Not very well, but he's capable of doing the job. Is he, you know, kind of emotionally immature? It certainly appears that way. But he's, you know, he's not, you know, divorced from reality. But this, you know, another thing, Mr. Wolf, who wrote this book, is no left winger. As you know, this is a guy who was a friend of Bannon's, and he comes in and writes this book. So I think the Republicans and the Trump people have to take this halfway seriously.
Let's bring in Tom in Madison. Tom, go ahead.
Good morning, folks, and thanks for the interesting program as usual. I just want to remind both the guests that I think both the current and former press secretaries have acknowledged and let the press know that the Twitter and the president's use of Twitter, they are official White House communication. I mean, it's well on the record that these are to be taken as, and, you know, the person goes on rants. I mean, I personally don't have a whole lot of respect for him as a president. I think he's done great as a salesman and what he does. But, they're official White House communication. It's easy to discount them as being rants or off the cuff or fueled by 12 Diet Cokes a day or whatever. But they are official.
Tom, thank you so much. Let's let Rick respond. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, you know, whether they're official communications or not is not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in whether or not they reflect public policy. And, you know, Lewis gave an example that most Republicans have been free traders, and I think that that's true. I'm a free trader. And one of the things that concerned me about Donald Trump was his protectionism. On the other hand, if you're in, we haven't really seen a great deal of protectionist initiatives from the administration, and so that's a good thing. I think that the tweets and sort of the sort of offhand and ill-considered statements are something that Trump would do well to abandon, because I think that they're what are driving his popularity ratings down, and a president has to remain popular in order to make good policy. But my point is simply that there is clearly a divergence between what happens on Trump's Twitter feed and what the administration actually does. And I would also argue that there's a divergence between a number of the issues that Trump ran on and a lot of the things that he said during the campaign and what the administration has actually done. For example, the conversation that we had at the beginning of the show, in which we talked about the deal that is about to be cut with respect to DACA and border security. This is not the way that Trump was talking during the campaign. What's actually happening on the ground, I think, is not exactly what we might have come to expect, sort of given the campaign rhetoric and some of the tweets and the offhand comments that are made.
Let's bring in one more call on this. Mary, go ahead, in Pewaukee. Hi, Mary, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. Yes, I just wanted to say I think your GOP guest is just trying to protect Trump only because he doesn't want the Republican Party to look bad. The Republican Party is not what it used to be. Trump, anyone that has listened to experts on different shows, including National Public Radio, Tavis Smiley, shows that air that have people that actually are in the psychological and psychology-based, you know, sciences know that he has a definite problem besides narcissism and, you know, losing his memory, possible Alzheimer's, who knows. But to try to protect him just to save face for the Republicans, that's my point of view. I would never vote Republican ever, ever again. Just because of their stands are, it's backwards. We're all going backwards with this.
Mary, thanks for the comment. Rick, I'm going to get you to respond here. Is President Trump driving away the Republican Party?
So, look, one of my concerns about, and sort of ironic that, you know, I'm put in the position of a, you know, Trump defender, because I've been a fairly consistent critic of Trump for the past year, is that if you look at what the administration has done, I think the record is relatively good from sort of a traditional conservative perspective. I do think that a lot of the president's personal behavior, a lot of the things that he tweets, a lot of the things that he says, however, threaten to diminish the Republican brand. And I think I've consistently said that he ought to knock this stuff off, because it's not helping him and it's not helping anybody else. But I think it would be less than honest for me not to acknowledge that there's a difference between policy and sort of the atmosphere that's created by, you know, what the president tweets at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning or wherever he does it.
Time is of an essence. The head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services says work and community involvement can make a positive difference in people's health. So she's allowing states like Wisconsin to seek work requirements for Medicaid recipients. Right now, people don't have to work to be on Medicaid, and experts say get ready for legal challenges over concerns that people may lose coverage. Lewis, what do you make of this development this week with Medicaid?
I certainly hope there are legal challenges. What's going on is you have people like Paul Ryan, whose goal, and he stated this numerous times, so this is not something that, you know, I'm making up here or anything like that. He is very interested in cutting back on the entitlements. That's Social Security, that's Medicare, and that's Medicaid. Medicaid is probably the easiest to go after because you're dealing with people who are suffering in various ways, whether they're poor, whether they're disabled, whether they're extremely elderly and they're in their nursing homes. And so this idea of a work requirement, and again, understand a work requirement is for those who are capable of working. But if this program was designed, these programs are going to be, the states are going to be coming up with their own ideas of how to do this. But you're not hearing it from states that are, you know, concerned about actually helping poor people. You're hearing it from states from that are kind of in a more punitive approach toward poor people. And if the if there were programs that were designed to provide job training and job counseling and helping people actually find work, and if that's what they're talking about, wonderful. And if that is what they're talking about, why aren't you doing it now without having a gun to people's heads? Because I think most people who are not working would like to be working.
Rick,
I'm just concerned about, you know, who's going to be behind these programs.
Rick, will Wisconsin be better or worse off under this work requirement?
Well, you know, at one point, in one level, I agree with Lewis, and the devil is in details. But, you know, we went through this debate when work requirements were imposed on cash welfare payments. We were told that the world was going to fall apart, and it turned out not to happen. We sort of know intuitively in the way that we deal with members of our families that sometimes it's not a good way to help somebody to give them things unconditionally. That sometimes conditions need to be imposed. That's how we help people improve their lives. Simply living on cash welfare payments and Medicaid isn't a very good way to live because, quite frankly, it's not particularly generous, and it doesn't respect human dignity and the desire to sort of work and be a valuable and productive member of society. So I think the notion that you impose a work requirement can actually be something which is more effective compassion and is more helpful to poor people than simply giving out benefits with no strings attached. But I understand that not everybody is able to work, and so to that extent, I agree with Lewis that the program has to be implemented properly, and it will be on those states who decide to pursue this waiver to do that.
Let's fit in one call here, Jean in Eau Claire on this. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just need to make one comment, and it's to everybody talking today. I need people to stop referring to Social Security and Medicare as entitlements. I have been paying into Social Security my entire life, over 50 years. I started working when I was 15. I'm retired, but I'm still working, and I'm still paying into Social Security. Medicare, I've paid into Medicare for the last 50-some years. And when people get Medicare, they pay for it. It's not a freebie. It's not an entitlement. And I think Democrats and Republicans, and especially Democrats, need to step up to the plate and stop referring to Medicare and Social Security as entitlements. We are all paying into it, and that is my comment. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Jean. I'll bounce back to Lewis before we take a little break. Lewis, go ahead.
Well, I mean, they're referred to in Washington as entitlement programs, and you know, you can break them down. She's absolutely right that Social Security and Medicare are being are paid for as a payroll tax, but there's still, I mean, the idea is that you should be entitled to get this, and the I have to move right now because there's people working on my window outside who are scraping. So let me.
We're going to let you move here a moment.
Okay.
And we need to also take a break here. We are in Week in Review on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And Louis Fortas is with us, editor in chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. And you can join in. 800-642-1234. Is Governor Walker right or wrong when he says we don't need more Madison in our lives? What do you make of the governor's race? 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment. You're along with us for Week in Review. We're knee-deep in the political developments of the week. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Rick Essenberg is the president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And Louis Fortas is editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What political story captured your attention this week? What developments are you following? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So last week, the Trump administration announced plans to greatly expand offshore oil drilling off the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. This week, Florida's Governor Rick Scott said he didn't like that idea, so the administration said it won't drill off the coast of Florida. Now the governor of South Carolina is saying he wants his state excluded from drilling plans as well. That is Democrats crying foul because similar requests from Democratic governors are not being granted. So, Rick, does this look like hypocrisy here to you, or is this something else going on?
Well, you know, I think that we have to be careful when we're talking about, all issues, but in the context of environmental issues, we have to be careful not to sort of take extreme positions in which we say all drilling is bad or all drilling is good. It certainly would be concerning if the partisan identity of a governor was to be used in order to determine whether or not a state's objection to offshore drilling would be respected or not. It doesn't surprise me that some Republican governors have been the ones who have objected, and because if you look at the partisan composition of governors, the supermajority of governors in the United States are Republicans, and so the odds are that any particular objection would come from a Republican. In terms of whether or not drilling off the coast of Florida or South Carolina is a good idea or not, I think, you know, ought to turn on an assessment of, you know, what the what the physical facts are, you know, what the hydrology shows, you know, what the costs and benefits are, and I hope that I trust that that's the way the EPA will address it.
Louis, the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke calls the criticism empty pandering and invites governors to set up a meeting with him. What do you say?
Well, I tend to agree with a lot of what Rick said. I think it should be on a case by case basis. I think the states off, you know, and the coastal states should have a big role in this, and I think that Zinke is probably one of the most political of Trump's appointments, and he has approached this and other things like the monuments and that in kind of a thuggish manner. So, I'd like to see them talking more and trying to be less political and a little more factual.
One more thing until we turn to state political news and in the governor's race. There's this little thing that came out this week. Oprah Winfrey may be getting into the 2020 presidential race. That caused a lot of Twitter action. Some Democrats got pretty excited following her speech at the Golden Globe Sunday night in which she voiced her support of women speaking out against sexual harassment. Let's hear a clip.
For too long, women have not been heard or believed if they dared to speak their truth to the power of those men. But their time is up.
Lewis, would you like to see Oprah give it a go in 2 years?
I think it'd be great to have Oprah as president. I just don't know why she'd want to do that to herself. She would be a very formidable candidate because when she was a talk show host, she actually listened to people and she learned a lot. And I think she has a great sensitivity for where America is and where Americans are at. So, yeah, I think she could do a great job. I just don't know why she'd want to do it to herself.
Rick, how seriously should we take this talk about a potential Oprah Winfrey bid?
Well, I don't think it's possible to dismiss it out of hand in that we elected a television star to be our current president, and I suppose it's not impossible that we would elect a television star to be our next one. Personally, I would prefer that we go back to politicians. Well, we go back to, you know, people who have experience in public office and public policy, and Oprah doesn't have that, and I don't think she's qualified to be president.
Shifting gears to state politics, after months of saying he was considering and later leaning toward a run for governor, Madison Mayor Paul Soglin made it official this week. He said a poll he did last spring convinced him he could lock up the Democratic nomination and then go on to defeat Governor Walker. Soglin spoke about the economy and said South Central Wisconsin is a big driver of the state's success.
When you take Dane, the seven counties that comprise the rest of the region, we are the ones that are making him look good. And he'd better say thank you.
And Walker reacted to Soglin's announcement on Twitter, saying the last thing we need is more Madison in our lives. Rick, should Governor Walker be worried about Paul Soglin?
You know, my guess is that he'd love to run against Paul Soglin. You know, Lewis is in Milwaukee, I'm in Milwaukee, you're in Madison, and I think that, you know, those of us in the sort of the I-94 corridor sometimes don't appreciate the extent to which it makes political sense in the rest of the state to run against Milwaukee and Madison. Soglin, I think, is someone who, you know, fairly or unfairly, is sort of associated with the sort of typical view of Madison as sort of a homogenous and conformist left-wing community. And I don't think that a candidate like that wins a statewide election. So if I'm Scott Walker, I'm kind of hoping that Soglin would be the candidate because my guess is that he would not be a particularly good statewide candidate.
Joan in Eau Claire, what do you make of this?
Good morning. Scott Walker will say anything to discredit any opposing candidate. How about the last thing we need is any more of Scott Walker in our governor's mansion? And while I don't think that Soglin will necessarily resonate with rural voters, the candidate I want to run against Walker is a candidate who can defeat Scott Walker. We need a grassroots candidate who can prevail against the dirty and dark money from the big money donors, yes, such as the Koch brothers. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Thanks, Joan. Let's go to Lewis now with reaction. Lewis?
Okay, first of all, I do think Wisconsin desperately needs a Democrat to win the next election because we need some balance back in this state. I mean, right now you have the whole state government controlled by Republicans. And, you know, when you have that much power for this long a period of time, it really gets abusive. And you begin to see that now as they just keep stretching for policy. So, but regarding Paul Soglin, you can't underestimate the guy. He's gotten elected three different times for mayor, and then he leaves, and then he comes back and does it again. He and Tony Evers both have a lot of executive
managerial experience in the public sector. That's important. And so, again, I think he brings some things to the table. It's going to be a pretty contentious primary for the Democrats. But, you know, he's somebody who's, you know, been elected. I say, like Tony Evers, they've both been executives in the public sector, and that's difficult.
The State Ethics Commission, moving on, is standing behind its leader as the Senate's top Republican says he'll be forced out. The board voted unanimously to back Brian Bell. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says lawmakers no longer have confidence in Bell's ability to be nonpartisan due to his work with the now disbanded Government Accountability Board. The Senate is expected to vote on rejecting Bell's confirmation in about a week and a half. We have had Nate in Milwaukee waiting to talk about this, and I want to give Nate the floor first. Nate, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. You didn't have to give me that big jump, but I appreciate it. I was going to say that I actually saw a Republican legislator give a speech about how nobody was above the law, and frankly, it's unfortunate that he wasn't talking about Wisconsin, where Republicans are doing a partisan witch hunt against members of the former GAB because they dared hold the governor and his associates accountable to the law that everybody else is, in theory, supposed to follow.
Rick, do you agree with Senator Fitzgerald's efforts to get Bell out? And Nate, thank you.
Well, you know, I think the problem is that the GAB, intentionally or unintentionally, embroiled itself in what turned out to be a partisan witch hunt. And the John Doe investigation was an investigation that was predicated on a theory of campaign finance law that was quite clearly not going to fly following the United States Supreme Court's decision in Wisconsin Right to Life 2 and the Seventh Circuit decision in a case called Barland 2. The lawyers who worked for the GAB should have known that, but they didn't. The GAB should have asserted its independence, but it didn't. It became staff captive, and we've since seen some very, very disturbing, you know, emails from some of the people who were within the GAB and some reports of, not necessarily by this individual, but reports of some very questionable behavior with respect to the handling of confidential information. And so it doesn't surprise me that, that someone associated with the GAB wouldn't have the confidence of the legislature.
Lewis, we're short on time. Should Bell be allowed to stay on as Ethics Commission Administrator?
Well, both the it's unanimous, both the Democrats and the Republicans on the committee want him. But one final thing is Rick is referring to the John Doe investigations as partisan witch hunts. No, they weren't. They sent six people to jail in the first John Doe, and the second John Doe was getting real close to Walker. And so the courts, the Supreme Court, which is, again, bought by literally $10 million in campaign contributions. And these were the people that closed down the John Doe. So it wasn't a partisan witch hunt. It was a real thing.
We're going to have to close down this conversation with Lewis and Rick. Thank you both so much. Lewis Fortas is editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee, and Rick Essenberg is the president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. This hour was produced by Bill Martins, Brianne Shasso, Keely Boltina, and Nyjah Ellison. Brittany Williams provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.